You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. You are absolutely going to love today's podcast, and I haven't even started it yet. I'm talking to journalist Kate Murphy, whose eclectic essays and articles for The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, The Economist have been shared and commented on by millions of people. She is known for her fresh and accessible style and ability to distill complex subjects, particularly the science behind human interactions, which is why this is so perfect for this podcast. Her first book, where she does talk about improvisation, and I got interviewed for that book, was called You're Not Listening, What You're Missing and Why It Matters. It was published in 32 languages, has become required reading in interpersonal communication courses in high schools, colleges, and universities worldwide. Her latest book is called Why We Click, The Emerging Science of Interpersonal Synchrony. Enjoy the pod. Kate Murphy, welcome to the podcast.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
This is so funny. So before we jump in, you were reminding me, because I forgot, that we talked like almost a decade ago for your first book, and you sort of observed improvisation, because this was, your first book was about listening, which is pretty vital in improvisation, it turns out.
Absolutely.
So let's stay on the improv theme for a little bit, because I have... Here's what I want to do. I want to tell you about three elements of my world over here, both in improvisation and Second City, and then get your response after I go through the three. Ready?
Okay, great.
The first thing is about mirroring. So some of the very first exercises that we have new students do when they start classes at Second City is simple mirroring exercises. And this is true in most theater programs. You pair up a couple people and you have them mirror the movements of each other. And you're trying to find that space where it's not really clear who is leading and who is following. And we have a concept in our work that comes from the great Viola Spolin, which is called follow the follower, where you are trying to sync with someone in such a way that sometimes you're leading, sometimes it's almost like a dance.
Yes. The
second is got your back. So before a cast steps on stage or facilitators begin a workshop, it's our tradition to physically tap each cast member or fellow teacher on the back, look directly into the other person's eye, and say, I got your back.
So wow.
We always do that. Okay, and the last is a improvised scene called Catch. So it was the mid-1990s, and Rachel Dratch created this improvised scene each night where she walked on stage, bouncing a basketball, made eye contact with one person in the front row, threw them the ball and had them start playing catch. And if it were a man, she made that person her dad. And if it was a woman, she made him her mom. And they had to improvise their lines as this character. And what we knew is it would never work if they weren't tossing the ball. But in tossing a ball, it created the space of connection and play that always made the scene work. And this thing was done eight shows a week for an entire year. Those are the three.
Wow. It's almost like everything that the science has since shown about how we connect and how we interpret one another, improvisation intuited that before there was actually the proof, the scientific proof, whether, you know, through all this hyperscanning and neural testing, that improvisation actually made manifest beforehand. That is so interesting.
It's wild, right? And so you probably don't know this. After I wrote the book, Yes and was doing this work, one of the things that I set up with my wife, Anne, was at the University of Chicago working with Nick Epley, primarily. It was called the Second Science Project. I know Nick's the best. I just talked to him the other day. So it was like a 4-year program, and we used improvisation to look at behavioral science and behavioral science to look at improvisation. So the self-disclosure thing was huge for us in his work, because we would then create exercises where people would practice like not great self-disclosure and then practice actual self-disclosure. And mm-hmm. they were then sort of like embodying the experience. So and it was such a natural fit. And it has been since. We've worked with a lot of folks in this community. We were embedded in classes in Harvard and that sort of thing, because it's actually, and it's not surprising if you just look at the basics of what we're doing here, which is creating recognizable human behavior.
Well, I think in the past, a lot of people have approached this by saying, oh, it's about vulnerability, or it's about, you know, sort of a physical connection with another person. But what they have discovered in the last few years through these advances in technology is what we actually do whenever we encounter another person is not only do we start, and this is all subconscious, but every minute little twitch, movement, behavior, not only do we start to sync up our movements, our gestures, we also uncannily start to sync up our heart rate, our respiration, our pupil dilation, and our hormonal activity. And so you can kind of think of it as this spidey sense that helps us distinguish friend from foe, and also sexual compatibility. But it's kind of like these improvisation exercises that you've almost blown it up to where it's more visible. And by virtue of that, when you physically start to mirror or mimic someone or just synchronize, whether it's finger tapping, rowing, running, singing, these things where you're doing the same thing, tossing the ball back and forth, that aligns you, your neural impulses physically, and that helps you align essentially, and not even metaphorically, hearts and minds, because all of that starts to align, and that's where people start to feel connection, really understand and interpret one another. So it's really fascinating how the improvisational world has almost preconceived what was later scientifically proved. That's so fascinating.
Well, why did theater evolve, right? Theater evolved for us to have a mirror by which we could see ourselves, right? I mean, this is such old stuff. And what's fascinating about it, too, is I'm reading Paul Eastwick's book right now, Bonded by Evolution. Do you know about Paul's work?
I have not read it, but I know what you're talking about.
So, and the basic premise of the book so far, I'm only a third of the way through, but like he's basically saying we've got these sort of Darwinian ideas around relationships that are just not true. So it is not tens and tens and fives and threes that are together. It's all about you meet someone, you have a reaction to them in a short term, and then over a long term, that develops into something else. And I couldn't help but thinking about your work and a bunch of stuff I've read lately where it's hugely important, because this stuff that we're talking about, and you write about this in the book, it's both why the world is the most amazing thing. We, you know, humans are incredible. There's magic to be had, and it's terrible. It could not be worse right now.
Yeah.
Same root.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're animals and we're very instinctive, and we like to think, I mean, we make up all sorts of reasons of why we like or not, or don't like somebody later. But a lot of it's based on that initial immediate feeling, that synchrony we develop or fail to develop with another person. And there are things that we can do to emphasize it, but it's really the degree and depth and duration of the synchrony that you have with another person determines the viability and stability of your relationship and whether a relationship develops at all. So yeah, it's all kind of a physical reaction. And I love what you said about magic, because there is a magic to it. We've all felt that, where you've met someone and just boom, instant connection. You're saying things like, yes, exactly. And it's so affirming and it's so wonderful, and you have no idea where it comes from. And it is what we used to call chemistry. It's actually synchrony. And it's all these, everything that goes into yourself are all of these twitches and neural oscillations and vibrations that actually find resonance with another person. And it's all the different things that made up that other person. I like to think of it, and it's really a pretty good metaphor, that we're all like these walking symphony orchestras playing at different frequencies and amplitudes, and we have all these different instruments playing it. And when you encounter another person who's got their whole orchestra, and it's whether or not you all can play in harmony. And the other thing I like about it is when people fail to click with another person, they generally have two reactions. It's either, what's wrong with that person? Or, what's wrong with me? That we didn't click. And the kinder reality is, maybe you two are just not a good fit. And that's okay. That is absolutely okay, because that's actually the natural order of things. We don't have the cognitive or emotional bandwidth to sync with everybody, to click with everybody. That's why it's so special when it occurs, and why we should really pursue those relationships and take note, because this little bit of magic that we know now because of the science, and I hope, you know, if you read my book, you'll see exactly what's going on inside, that it is still magic, and it is still a wonderful thing that you should celebrate and pursue.
The symphony metaphor is interesting. I was listening to a podcast with a couple of the founding members of the band Chicago, and they were critiquing their Carnegie Hall album. And basically they said, Carnegie Hall was not built for electronic instruments. That's why it doesn't sound good. So what's interesting about that is yes, there's the symphony, but then there's like, that's a building, that's a place that just wasn't built for this thing. So when you're talking about why there's not synchrony, it can be so much more than the simple story we want to tell ourselves.
Yes.
And that's what's so interesting. Okay. Let's go to sort of some root stuff. This is all in chapter one. You say, quote, there is well-documented tendency of mothers, regardless of whether they are right or left-handed, to cradle their infants in their left arms and the left side of their bodies. Why?
Because your heart is on the left side, and babies sync up to their mother's heart rate. And that is, and particularly when they're newborns, they need that synchrony to kind of, it's like pacing. And children within the womb, of course, are paced with their mother, with everything that she does, they're totally synced. And right after when they're born, that's why they talk about, it's called kangaroo care, where it's skin-to-skin contact, where it helps regulate the baby and get the baby used to being essentially no longer within that amniotic fluid, and now they're needing to breathe and be viable in our world.
And then kissing lines up with us sometimes in terms of the way we kiss.
Oh, yes, because we also turn. Well, the other reason why you're held in the left hand is because your visual view is looking to the left, which because of the lateralization of the brain, that's where emotional decoding happens. And so that's also why people generally turn their head to the right, putting the person who they love on the left before they kiss, because that helps with emotional decoding. So it all makes sense. Everything we all do, and you know, and everybody, when they read that passage, I can see them and they're all like, yeah, actually, I do that.
Yeah, that's right. And then it's interesting, too, where you talk about, and no offense to anyone who's gotten Botox, God love you, whatever, but how that might screw that up a little bit for people, right?
Well, absolutely, because we're doing all these sort of mimicking or mirroring other people's micro expressions. Of course, what you've talked about in improvisation, it's much more visible, and you're trying to do things that are visible. But there's so many things that are under the radar that we're doing, just these micro twitches that we do, little micro expressions that we are mimicking. And it's all of these muscles in the face. And when people get Botox, that effectively freezes those expressions. So you can't mirror the other person. And the reason why we do that mirroring is because when you reflexively smile, when someone else's smile, when people flinch, when someone gets hit, That is actually how you are empathizing with the other person. You actually are emoting with them, even when it's not necessarily visible, because they're like micro expressions and they're very flash quick that people are picking up. So again, when you get Botox, that freezes that. And that's why often, I don't know if you've had I agree with you, God love you, whatever, you want to do. Mm-hmm. But I think we've all had the experience where a friend has gotten some work done and there's something kind of unsettling when like the eye jobs and the face is like frozen and you're expecting, this is subconscious, you're expecting that mirroring. You're expecting that. And so it's a little bit jarring. And for the person who does have Botox, it's harder for them to interpret other people's feelings. There's been a lot of research on this. Even when they've had people like hold a pencil in their mouth so they couldn't move their mouth when they're talking to somebody, they had a much harder time interpreting the other person's feelings and emotions. So it's fascinating.
What? Why? How? Why did they? Is it go back to that sort of like... some sort of neuroplasticity that gets lost when you physically can't move? Do we know why?
Well, they're still working on this, but the idea is it's sort of this idea that started with mirror neurons, which they're not even quite sure about mirror neurons, whether or not they're actually a separate class of neurons or if it's just endemic of all neurons. But what happens when we are talking to someone, seeing someone, within us, we actually start to mirror what they're doing in our brains. Our brains start to fire off when we see someone smile and we do that reflexive mirroring. It is a signal to our brain, oh, that person's happy, or oh, that person's sad. And so when you block that, you can't do that interpretation. It's almost like you have to physically do the method acting of this minute and totally subconscious and not necessarily visible. But have you ever watched a movie and looked around and seen other people's faces moving with the person in the movie? Or you even caught yourself doing, changing your expression? That's exactly what you're doing with another whenever you're interacting with another person. Media is just because media is relatively new. We're doing the exact same thing when we watch a movie. Our primal, evolutionary, earlier brain is doing the exact same thing when we watch a movie that we do with other people, live people.
So it's so interesting because. All right. I think back to COVID days, right? So Second City has to shut down. And I had actually been talking to the Zoom folks prior to this, not because I knew anything was happening, just it was a fluke. So we were all set up on Zoom. So we basically just moved all the workshop business, my keynotes that I used to do live, I was now doing on Zoom because we have, media background at Second City built in. We knew we were doing a TV show. So we weren't trying to do, we changed it to a TV, like we're doing a TV show. It's going to be different. But ultimately, and while that was a savior for the business that we were able not to go under, we still do stuff on Zoom. I haven't done a Zoom keynote in ages. It's not the same.
No.
There is not the same connection. And God love that we have this capability for people who, when they're sick or if they have a disability of some kind and all of that, embrace it, keep it. But it is not a replacement for being in the room with another human being and what that means to us, which is basically you're giving up your superpower in exchange for a much smaller power, I think, when you sacrifice being in a room with another person.
Well, even worse than that, part of it is because this is a multi-sensory, syncing with another person is multi-sensory. It isn't, it is there. We're picking up vibes, for lack of a better word, that we cannot even measure yet. They don't even know all the things that are going on. But there's olfactory. There's just the electrical energy between the other people, between you and the other person. But the problem with things like Zoom is the way the technology is set up is that it actually, because of to preserve bandwidth, it actually distorts the signal. it smooths over a lot of those micro expressions we were talking about. So you're expecting to see those and you're not. And that's where something called Zoom fatigue, where you know, everybody's experienced it. It's because your brain is sort of racing to try and do that mirroring, that dance that you normally do socially with another person. And it's not there, or it's distorted, or there's that stuttering, or there's just, and it's a lot that you're not even aware of that you're trying to pick up that is just not there with Zoom. So it's not only that you don't get all the whole panoply of signals from being in person with another, with being in the room with another person. It's also you're getting distorted signals from the signals that you're receiving.
Mm. All right. Let's talk about another Second City thing. So I started at Second City. My first gig was in 1988 as a dishwasher. And then very quickly, I started hosting the room. So wow. In 1988, okay, what was it like then? You could smoke in the room? It was the way it was classic cabaret. So in the old school cabaret, the tables were, everyone's very close to each other, still are. The tables were sort of, you were actually not even focused at the stage. You were sitting across from people. You had to turn your body. It was very uncomfortable. There was all these sort of rules about this room that was also too cold. And that was that on purpose to sort of keep it. And the chairs weren't necessarily comfortable. And so all these things that you think would be, you know, like you should have comfortable chairs and you should have the temperature were all things that were in our world and still are to some extent anti-comedy. You delve into this later in the book in terms of an experience at the Comedy Cellar. Can you tell us about what happened there?
Well, there's so much happened there when I was there. Yeah. But Noam Dorman, who is the owner, who's just, I'm such an admirer of his now. I mean, he's just such a philosopher. Mm-hmm. But he was telling me about several instances. One that I talk about in, is there is an actual table upstairs in the restaurant where a lot of the performers hang out. And it's called the comedian's table. And when there was a renovation done, that Noam, because it is like such an iconic table, he said, you really cannot, you can do anything you want, but you cannot change the table. But in fact, the table was moved. And the tables moved, you know, less than 3 feet, but the comedians just went nuts. Just, they were very upset about it and that he changed everything. It no longer had the aura. It was just absolutely awful. You know, people like Chris Rock were just railing on him. It was actually very painful for Noam. And so Noam's like, okay. And moved it back. And he was saying, you know, I haven't looked into it scientifically, but just that little bit of movement into the room, it actually changed the feeling. And it was essentially in the splash zone of everybody else in the bar. And there is something about space that causes us to sync or not sync with people. And it intensifies the signal, so to speak. And Noam went on to tell me, then once they put it back, all the comedians were fine with it. It was just that closer because there was just more intensity of signal from other people in the room. These personal signals that we pick up from one another, the playing of everybody's orchestra, that you wanted mm-hmm. some space. But he also went on to tell me is down in the actual Comedy Cellar that he wants to purposely crowd people together because yeah. the reaction is so much better. It doesn't guarantee something will be funny, but if something is funny, it will make it that much funnier when everyone's crowded together. And there was one instance where they were doing a renovation in one of the clubs, and there was just a little bit of a gap between the final row and the other rows. And Noam came in and said, this is no good. He said, comedy, and I love this quote, is he said, comedy needs to be like coach, not like first class seats where there's a lot of room around you. You need to crowd people together. And it is true. If you've ever gone yeah. to the Comedy Cellar or any other comedy club, and I'm sure like what you're talking about at Second City, if you are crowded together with everybody, you pick up on that energy, that vibe in the room. And when someone is really good, you can walk into the room when a comedian's on and when they're hot, you walk in, you don't even have to have heard anything. You just walk in the room and you feel it. And the same thing when they're bombing, you walk in the room and you're like, whoa, You didn't have to hear any of the jokes or whatever. You just feel it. And again, it is that energy that we sink to. And it can also lead to very negative things like, you know, social contagion and mass hysteria. But that's actually where the root of it is. And that's why we do like to gather close together in these types of environments to really intensify our feelings and emotions.
It's not so different than like club dancing and going to rock concerts. And
right.
I know I'm turning 60 this year and I no longer fest. People are always like, hey, are you going to go to Lollapalooza? I'm like, I don't fest anymore. What I know about myself is that I do not want to stand for that long. I'm less comfortable in crowds of people at my age, but I love music. And so what I try to do is find the various concert halls where I know I will have a seat and that it works for me and I can have that experience. So I think there's also just that reality, because I was at Second City for a show over my wife directed one of the holiday shows, and we came with my son. And my son, who has also like worked in the box office of Second City and, you know, like knows he grew up here, he's uh-huh. like, the seating is too tight. And I'm like, dude, this is what it is. And I'd be like, I get that, you know. So I think there's some stuff around age, and there's other things about, you know, what spaces you want, because I don't go club hopping anymore. But then I think what's crucial is we have to replace, if we're not going to go do those experiences, uh-huh. how do we find sort of healthy, good places to synchronize? So, because it's not in online forums.
No.
That is absolutely not what it, so like, we have to be more intentional, I think, about finding these places where we can put ourselves in the world, in proximity to humans, in these spaces, to be our full human selves. That seems important.
Well, you bring up a good point about people's tolerance for that signal, because for people have different a sensitivity of tuners, shall we say. And for receiving those signals. And some people are much more sensitive than others. And also, let's be honest, at a lot of these fests, as you say, people are stoned and yeah. they're drinking a lot to really quell that. I mean, that's mm-hmm. a lot of the research is to actually quell that. Because if they weren't stoned, it would be too much. It would be way too much. All of that human energy, all of those signals that they're receiving, it would just, you know, make you explode. So let's talk about that. But also, it's context driven as well. And you do get to a point where your sensitivity is such that you decide, maybe I don't want to fest, or maybe I don't want to be stoned while I'm in these circumstances. So everybody's different in the degree to which they can manage other people's energy. And some people have larger space zones than others where they feel like, okay, that's too close, you know, in terms of somebody standing next to them. So, but there's that. But also, I do think if we're thinking about this and we think about millennia, I mean, people have gathered together in church services mm-hmm. and sang together, prayed together, done these things that synchrony has been acting as a social glue since before we've even recorded. And also think about soldiers marching together. I mean, it is a way to build cohesion. So however you want to do that so it's comfortable, it could be a knitting club where you're all sitting around doing the same thing. It could be cycling, it could be rowing, it could be dancing, it could be singing, it could be even volunteering at a soup kitchen where you're all working in a line and doing something in synchrony. But it does require you to be in the presence of other people. And so it is to really keep in mind that to really experience interpersonal synchrony and to really click with someone on that fundamental level, it is multisensory, and you need to be in one another's presence.
So here's another thing I wanted to talk to you about, because I thought you would dig it based on what you're writing about and something you don't know that we've been involved with.
Uh-huh.
Some time ago, we got a call from this guy named Vince D'Alfonso, who was a retired agent of the FBI, and he was teaching at the FBI National Academy, and he teaches hostage negotiation. Uh-huh. He was He was the lead negotiator for the Boston Marathon bombers. Also Captain Phillips. He was the one doing that. He helped solve the DC sniper case. And he had started listening to my podcast over COVID. And he's like, I think improvisation would help folks who to learn hostage negotiation. So we went to Quantico for a week.
Wow.
And we taught these classes. Uh-huh. And we're continuing to do this work with the University of Chicago Crime Lab, working with senior law enforcement when people found out we were doing it. And what amazed me was how quickly they got it, that they got when they practiced the improv, you know, when we had them do this, the classic yes and exercise. So, you know, what's it like to say no? What's it like to say yes, but, and what's it like to say yes and? And immediately they got it because they're like, oh, we're practicing what we need. We have to form a connection with these people in seconds. Yep. And if we lose that, they're done. Maybe we're done. Others could be done. So judgment, like you can't live in your judgment brain. You have to be in the sort of pure improvisational brain. And for most of them, they'd never had embodied training. They'd only had book training.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, it's very much being in the moment and letting go, because the research also shows that people who are narcissists, people who have anxiety disorders, people who have difficulties that make them more inward focused, have a real hard time syncing to other people, because it really has to be a laser focus on the other people where you almost let yourself go and become the other person. Allow that synchrony to happen. And that does, there's a little bit of courage involved in that, a lot of courage to give yourself over like that. But, you know, if you think of some of these people in the FBI, you know, they're pretty brave and courageous people. They're jumping in with both feet and let me experience that. And there's also has to be a confidence in knowing that you can pull yourself back out of it. And I think that's where people have more difficulty. I think people focus more on how do I sync with people, when it's really more how do you pull back when you have developed that synchrony, when you're totally the other person, you've embodied the other person, how do you let it go? Because a lot of us lose ourselves in the other person and maybe get tied up in their anxiety, in their anger, in their outrage, and it's catching. It's contagious. And to know when that's happening, catching when that's happening, and being able to give it back. And I'm going to let you have your feelings, and I'm going to retain myself.
That's hard. And one of the really important podcasts that we did last year was with Caroline Fleck, who has a book called Validation. Mm-hmm. It was basically said across all so many of these therapies, and she's a psychologist, that the one thing that is consistent, whether it's like a 12-step program or EMDR or whatever, is this idea of just validating the feelings that are across from you and the person. If you simply validate, like, that sucks, I hear you, that sucks, and you don't take it any further,
right.
Just validate. That's an application that I have used. I got a great marriage. It's done wonders inside my own relationship, because you have a tendency. We all have a tendency to, like, okay, let me give you some ways I think I can help you, or let's problem solve this together. How about just validate the feelings of the person across from you and let that sit for a little bit? It's a really powerful tool, and it's good for both parties.
Well, the thing is if you think about that instinct to fix. Where that's coming from is actually, I can't handle the feelings that I've synced with you. And so I've got to fix this so I don't feel this way anymore. And I'm not saying you don't feel for the other person. You obviously do, because you've taken them into yourself. But part of that urgency is kind of the same thing when people get hyper positive around somebody who's depressed. Look on the bright side, because they're trying, they can't. They're having a hard time being down with the other person. And that is our instinct. We have an instinct to sync. So we have actually, and it's not just in our minds and in our emotions, it's physically occurring within you. You have synced to their heart rate, their respiration, their pupil dilation. You have embodied, in essence, to a greater or lesser extent, become that person. So that's why you have that urgency of, okay, let's find a solution. oh, you know, look on the bright side, trying to bring both of you back up together. So there is an incredible skill of saying, oh, you know, I feel that, I understand that, but also being able to, and it helps the other person as well, because the other person feels bad telling you something
right.
that's sad, because they don't want to take, they know on some level that you're taking it on. So we've all heard people say, oh, I'm so sorry for being a downer. I shouldn't be complaining. I shouldn't be, and there's such a freedom when they know that you can hear it, and you can take it in and you can sympathize, but you are not going to become them, that you're able to retain yourself. And as a result, the other person can kind of come back out of it and almost sink to you. Instead of ricocheting despair back and forth, because that's often what you do when you're very synced with, say, your spouse or a best friend or a child. When and you can just climb this ladder of agitation and arousal, or descending in the other direction of getting into the pit of despair, that if one of you is able to stay stable and is able to kind of bring the other person very subtly, and they know that you are a rock that they can hold on to, it's liberating for both of you.
Mm. All right. Before I ask you for your yes and story, you participated in some psychodrama.
I did.
And you did not want to do it.
That may be my yes and story, Kelly.
It's fine if it is. Because I've done some research. I understand, obviously, because there's three schools of improvisation. Spolin, which is what we do. A guy named Keith Johnstone, who's where comedy sports and different, where basically he was using improv to write plays. That's kind of what it was. And then Augusta Boal, Theater of the Oppressed, psychodrama, a lot lived in that world. So how did you enter that? And at what point did you know you had to like go into that Viper's Nest?
Yeah. That was rough for me. actually I was doing research by attending a lot of jury trials.
Yeah.
And I was really getting the sense of lawyers who were really good at syncing not only with witnesses, with the judge, with jurors, really connecting with them to get their argument across, but also being able to just read the room. And so that's, you know, those are two distinct reading different individuals versus reading a room. Well, the ones that I found were the most effective trial lawyers were the ones, and I had never heard of this, but they did psychodrama, which I had never heard of. It sounded kind of scary. I mean, mm-hmm. psychodrama. Mm-hmm. And what it is they essentially get their client and they go through the traumatic experience of whatever the case is about and actually reenact it together in an improvisational way. And it's very intense. It's, as you might imagine, because this has been brought to trial, it's very emotional. And so I, you know, when I heard about it, I thought, well, I got to investigate this because, I mean, it was striking. The lawyers who did this, they were the best. They were just so in tune and so able to connect with jurors, and they won cases. So I asked if I could participate in a psychodrama. I found people who were their trained psychologists who have an extra certification in psychodrama. And I asked, and I participated in more than I would like to have participated in to get a sense of this. And they wouldn't let me observe, Kelly. They
no,
wouldn't
you can't.
No, and it makes sense. Everyone has to be vulnerable in that experience, and everyone has to be in it. So I mean, I'm somebody who doesn't even, I get turned off by a lot of theater because anything that seems like forced emoting to me is just, it makes me cringe. I cannot stand stuff like that.
Yeah.
But it was an incredible experience. And you get so caught up in the way psychodrama works is not only do you're given a role, like say I was a nurse, I was a scuba dive instructor, I was all of these different roles, but you would trade places in the middle of the scene. The psychologist said, okay, you all switch roles. And then all of a sudden I was the client.
Yeah.
And I describe in the book, in one very intense scene, I was discussing sexual dysfunction that was related to the injury. And so I was at first the girlfriend of the client, and then I would switch roles and I had to be the client in these conversations. And I will say this client wasn't particularly likable. He really mm-hmm. wasn't. But after you go through that, and I won't say that, you know, I ended up loving the guy, but I will say that if I was ever called upon to represent him faithfully and in fact, forcefully, I would be able to do it because of that experience. And it's incredibly powerful and incredibly uncomfortable. So
there's a line that when we interviewed Morgan Housel that his brother gave to him, which I have shared so many times on this podcast, because it to me, it just is simple and profound, which was, everyone's behavior makes sense if you have enough information.
Yeah.
And I think the kind of information that you got in that experience was deeper than like data, deeper than a fact about a human. It's when you embody a character, a thing, you learn a whole lot that otherwise you just wouldn't. And we are talking about life and death in these situations, right? Potentially, or you know, so mm-hmm. it's about someone's
absolutely.
Life. So pull out all the stops, please. And that's why this work, our work, belongs in these spaces where otherwise people would be like, why are you bringing in an improv troupe? And it's like, no. Like it's just another tool that we can use in this experience. And so I just think that's your yes and story, right?
That would pretty much be it.
Yeah.
I mean, I can give you other ones, but I think that's a huge one because
it's a good
I did
one.
Not want to do that.
No. And that's, again, that's fine. But then you do it and you make that discovery about yourself. And this stuff it's hard. It's the work one does in therapy. I mean, like, yeah, I had an amazing therapist that like, and we did EMDR. And so that was really for me, the pinnacle that was where things sort of like, and I did, cause I did not know what I was holding in my body and what, cause I'm, you know, we can be very good at telling ourselves a certain kind of story mm-hmm. About our past. And it was incredible to have that open up, and it became, I mean, it was just, you suddenly find yourself sobbing. You're like, where does that come from? And it's like, it just needed to be released. And it was in the same way. I remember I came into therapy. So we'd gone through this whole thing. It was very successful. I get in there. I'm doing like I always do. We should talk about books with my therapist. And I just dawned on me. I'm like, are we done? And she smiled at me and she had gotten out the little trinket that she gives who her clients when they have their last session. She's like, I knew you were going to say that today. And it was just one of those things where it's like, and we had a big hug. And I was just emailing with her because we check in every now and again. And I just recall, talk about synchrony, man. This woman like just built up this over a period of time. And then there was this sort of thing where we kind of both knew, at least for now, you know, it's done. And I just look back and be like, that was hard. The experience was hard. And
yeah.
what a gift. What an absolute gift to me.
Yeah. I think people discount the power of synchrony with another person and helping you heal and helping them understand you. And I think that's so important, not only in our own relationships, to pay attention to, am I in sync with this person? And not only just in our personal relationships, but also when you're talking about therapy, that, you know, when you go in, if you don't have that connection, if you don't feel like you're in sync with that person, find somebody else.
Absolutely. 100%.
And it's not something you can force. And I hope if anything people take away from this book is that, again, we talked about this earlier, you're not going to click with everyone. And that's okay. You will find the person that there is just a special alchemy. And it doesn't mean that you're exactly alike. Because think mm-hmm. of all the odd couples and mixed match of people that you see in this world. There's something fundamental about whether your orchestra plays in harmony with their orchestra. And it's still a mystery and it's still magic, but it is something you should pay attention to.
The book is called Why We Click, The Emerging Science of Interpersonal Synchrony. Everyone should get this book. Kate Murphy, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, it was a pleasure. So nice to see you again.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.